This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to look at the constitutionality of a Jim Crow-era law in Louisiana. The Black Alliance for Peace joins demonstrations in Washington against U.S. war policies. And Muslim and Jewish activists say white supremacy is behind the campaign to silence Representative Ilhan Omar.
But first, the Ujima People's Progress Party is gearing up for a statewide conference in Baltimore, Maryland. Nnamdi Lumumba is one of the organizers of Ujima, which has chapters throughout the state of Maryland. The theme of the conference is Elections and Beyond, Building Independent Solutions for the Black Community.
The Election Beyond concept really started with, you know, every 4 years we go into this cycle and you get this hype of who's going to be the next Democratic candidate to represent the Democratic Party. It gets the Black community all in a tizzy. You have people who are asking who are the candidates who are appearing, some of them less known than others. And we get really geared up as a community for voting time, but we don't ask the question about what are our political interests, what are our economic interests, what do we do in between elections. That's what we really wanted to build on. And obviously going into this election season, we want people's ears are alert. And so we want people to be thinking beyond the elections. And of course, people are talking about what are the agendas that we're putting in front of them. But I think as a community and as a class, as Black workers, we need to have that information prepared well in advance, whether it's the election time or what happens day to day at City Hall or in the state capitol.
Well, I'm sure everybody heard you say, as a class, as Black workers, clearly your party's agenda puts Black workers first.
Oh, absolutely. The truth is that in a modern society, all elections, all parties have class character. Participating in elections without being aware of your class interests or being aware of the class interests of those you vote for puts you at a serious disadvantage. So for us, it's important to talk about class, race, ethnicity in the mix. We do recognize that workers in general do share some common struggles, but the truth is that progress in America has almost always come as a consequence of Black struggle, and that when Black struggle happens, it opens doors for other people. So we're not going to have just any kind of struggle, and we're not going to vote for just any candidate. We want to be clear of our class interests. We want to be able to capitalize on those advancements and be able to hold on to those things so that we can move forward and make ourselves a stronger community and as a class as well.
Baltimore has always been a working class town. It's been about two-thirds Black for a very long time, and the Black political establishment is well entrenched. What has that done for Black working class folks?
Moved us backwards in history. Unfortunately, we have gotten used to having Black faces in high places here. Of course, like you said, Baltimore has a very large African population. The state of Maryland has an exceedingly high percentage of Black people here. I believe we have the fifth highest concentration of Black citizens in Maryland throughout the whole country. So it represents a big opportunity for us to utilize our power, not just at the ballot, but like I said, as a class, to be able to move forward the kind of things we want to see. The problem is that in our relationship to the Democratic Party, we've allowed the Black become the spokesman for our community. They actually function as gatekeepers, as a misleadership class that advances even further the kind of agendas that had a white person been in office would be very seriously struggled against. And so it really, again, has thrown us backwards as a community. I think a report just recently came out that showed that gentrification throughout the country, Washington, D.C., just 50 miles to the south of us, was rated number one. and Baltimore was rated 6th in the country. So the work to depopulate the city is underway, and there are no answers coming from our black political class to stop that. Instead, they're helping to advance it as quickly as possible.
And in fact, the black political class has been very much involved in tearing down public housing over the years, and many of those black political establishments have facilitated gentrification.
Yes. How do you struggle against some of these people? These people, obviously, for us, don't pop up out of nowhere. They have actual relationships here. Some of them have deep roots with families who've had histories as a part of the black political class. Some of them made their teeth back in the civil rights movement. But today's a different day. And it's clear that when you look at their agenda, they don't have an agenda that represents the vast majority of people in the African community or even working people. The majority of black people in this city are working class. We find ourselves being pushed out. And of course, you use things like the state, whether it's the police, whether it's the courts. These things are help facilitate and expedite the kind of push out that we're seeing. And like I said, you can't wait for an election for this to happen. You have to have capacity. You have to have the ability to organize, to articulate what your interests are and how they're different from the vision that the Democratic Party with its black misleadership class is putting forward. And that takes organization. And again, that's what we're calling for, to think beyond the elections. And we understand this. It's very difficult for black organizers, radical or progressive forces to participate in winning these type of elections. But the election time gives us a great opportunity to take the work that we've been doing every day, the battlefront struggles that we've had, and to bring them into the electoral arena, to not become something different, but to continue to be who we are, put out our politics, to be able to organize and recruit, to be able to find people who can understand what we're saying and build power, right? Because that ultimately is for us what elections are really about, winning power. Of course, if you win the election, you win control of the state so that you can implement some of your plans. But you can build people's power. You know, we can do that from the ground up. We can build institutions. We can build organizations. We don't need to wait for a victory at the electoral box to be able to build power and to be able to move our community forward.
How long has the Ujima People's Progress Party been in existence? What have you learned and what mistakes have you made?
We're entering our 9th year. For several years, we attempted early on to try to get on the ballot. And that process is very difficult here in Maryland. We've been asked a lot of times, why don't we just do this and that? But we know exactly what it takes. And we've even had chance to speak with the other third parties that do exist here. Actually, two of them just got removed from the voter ballot, which is the Green Party here, and as well as the Libertarian Party. Their answer was very clear to us, and something that's usually out of reach of black workers. They spend money, anywhere from $20,000 to $30,000, to get on a ballot. The truth is, if African workers as an organization had $20,000 to $30,000, we would spend it on implementing some kind of fight back program, some kind of institution. Ideally, we wouldn't want to spend it on just creating a political party. So we understand that contradiction. We've had a chance to run some candidates, myself being one. That was a very interesting lesson. We learned that people are listening and people want real answers. There are a lot of people who didn't have any intention of voting. And we don't know if they voted or not, but we know that during the election and afterwards, they were more motivated to come to the kind of events that we were holding, more interested in some of the discussions we were having about our solutions. And so we learned that you can't run an election with the major concern about trying to win an election. Obviously, you do the right things to put yourself in place. You go to the forums, you go to doors of doors, and you do all of that. But valuing the contacts, the relationships, being able to bring people into political organization. We've had a chance to build a political education capacity called the Fannie Lou Hamer Leadership Development Institute, being able to get people engaged, sometimes at very basic levels about understanding how the city and state government works, but moving them to understanding, you know, the kind of questions that black workers have as a class and as a nation of people. We have to take advantage of those opportunities because, again, this is an opportunity where people are used to hearing political speak. They're used to letting you knock on their doors. They're used to coming out. You get entry to places that most black progressives and radicals don't get access to. And we need to make the most advantage of that and not fumble the ball. I think that's the one contradiction that we really regret, that we didn't follow through and be able to really consolidate all those contacts and build an institution, an instrument of class struggle. And that's not a mistake we're going to repeat.
Yes, you're a black political party, but one that does not put all its eggs in the electoral basket and talks the same language at election time as when you're engaged in other forms of struggle.
That's an important part of the work that we're doing. I think the truth is that people are tired of being sold a bag of beans and plans that don't work. They want to hear the truth. They want to be refreshingly told what the real contradictions are and what the solution is going to be. I think it challenges some people's ability to really think outside the box, because we've been trained as a class and as a group of people to always look for who's going to win the race. But, you know, winning the race has never worked for us as a community. There is no historic proof that as a community that any of our struggles have been resolved because someone won an election. It's always been through political struggle that we've been able to force the hand of political forces to be able to implement change. And that's still consistent. And that's what that language is about, being able to be authentic and giving people a clean glass of water so that they can choose to move forward. And again, it's not even whether people can vote. It's about whether people can see the future for themselves and organization as the real answer so that you can build power beyond the elections.
And is the environment in Baltimore and Maryland getting better or worse in terms of receptivity to black radical politics?
It's getting better. I think, again, we're in a situation that doesn't always exist throughout the country. Being in a majority black city, there are less illusions about a black person winning as the mayor or city council president or even the state's attorney. Those things are well established. We've only had hiccups and blips in the last 20, 30 years where someone white was able to win those high positions locally. Around the state, you see a growing number of, especially young black workers, who are, if they do register to vote, are choosing to register as independents, which we think is a good sign because people, at the very least, fed up with the two-party system. So, yeah, the acceptance has been good. Even non-African people have been open to it. The discussion around the whole class struggle is important, trying to help people understand that we ourselves don't place class above race, but we understand that they have a relationship and that we call on white workers who want to have real unity to check themselves and to be able to understand that there is no progress in Baltimore if it does not benefit the majority of the people, who, which again, are African workers.
So how do you plan with this conference to take advantage of those developing opportunities?
So during the conference, we have brothers and sisters coming from throughout the state of Maryland, Prince George's County, which is a county which actually has even more black people than the city of Baltimore, Eastern Shore, Western Maryland, Frederick, Maryland, to be more specific. We have comrades coming from throughout the region, Pennsylvania, D.C., Virginia, New Jersey. So we're trying to be able to bring some of these folks together who either been working in the electoral arena, who've been critiquing the blackness leadership class, and who actually have been on the ground making fights against gentrification, trying to win economic justice. We've got black organizers who are in the unions. We have people who organize in grassroots organizations to do like fight back type of work. And of course, just the kind of work that it takes around organizing political, independent black political action. So we're trying to bring some folks who we can build together with, not just around this conference, because coming out of this, we want to be able to have a good coalition so that we can support each other throughout this state, throughout the region, be able to move our forces and not fight these battles alone. We recognize that some of these city councilmen and some of these small districts, these are not really significant forces unto themselves. Successful struggles can be waged against them if they have this proper support, you know, people organized in those areas. And to be able to bring more forces from around the state to bear on some of these forces will be able to help move things forward locally for each of us. And we see that as a big advantage.
That was Nnamdi Lumumba of the UGMA People's Progress Party speaking from Baltimore.
Activists from around the nation traveled to New Orleans to join protests against Louisiana's Jim Crow era law that allows defendants to be convicted when only 10 of 12 jurors turn in a guilty verdict. The U.S. Supreme Court last week agreed to decide on the constitutionality of that law. We spoke with Belinda Parker Brown of Louisiana United International, one of the groups demanding that the thousands of people now imprisoned under the 10-2 law be set free.
Some of my comrades from across the country came out to stand with us and support the efforts in exposing the injustice in our corrupt criminal justice system down here in Louisiana. We just recently fought a fight to take a racist, unconstitutional Jim Crow law off the books, which is known as the 10-2. It was only two states that did that, that had the, you can actually get a conviction on a felony and sentence people to life in prison with just 10 jurors. So we were successful in November of 2018 of taking that unconstitutional racist law off the books. The people came out and we rallied the people to vote that they no longer wanted a law. So like that, that where actually the law was schemed up to protect the white supremacists so that they can literally go and snatch black people off the streets and put them in prison and make slaves out of them. So, you know, I'm so excited right now because the attention is on Louisiana. I believe that Louisiana can be the model for the whole world to see what happens when people stand up and fight against this type of injustice. And I'm so excited because of the fact that, you know, we got the whole world watching us now. We're able to do some live screaming with some of my friends that came down from New York, Ralph Pointer, Betty Davis, Reverend Edward Pickney, and the Chairman O'Malley, and also we had Anthony Evans, Pastor Anthony Evans, that is with the National Black Church Initiative, on board with us to bring attention. So I believe by all of these people that were and supporters coming from the outside to help us down here, it really terrified the people down here in Louisiana because we were able to do quite a few radio interviews as well as TV, and they're watching every move we make. You know, whenever you get into a movement, people are paying attention, you know, the powers that be. So it wasn't a day or so after a lot of the attention that was being put on this focus was unanimous is not enough. The unanimous is not enough campaign is what we said that we were going to fight until they get it right because we have over 2,000 people that are sitting in prison that was convicted up under this racist, unconstitutional law. And we're saying that these people deserve the opportunity to have a fair trial or else be let go free. So, you know, we're not going to stop until they get it right and until these people get relief or redress so that they can get justice and hopefully come home to their loved ones.
There must have been a real sense of satisfaction when it was announced that the Supreme Court's going to look into this law's constitutionality.
Yes, I am very pleased with the Supreme Court that they did accept one of the cases that had went before them sometime in September. But I do want to make it clear that I'm excited about the fact that they are basically watching and looking at what's happening here with this movement thrusting people that are watching Washington, D.C., the Supreme Court, whoever it may be, that we're not just going to stand idly by and just say, this is okay. You know, we're going to take whatever y'all give us. So the case that the Supreme Court have decided to hear is a case that would actually give us an opportunity to shine more light on the unanimous is not enough, that the campaign that Louisiana United launched in February, that we're saying that we don't care about the fact that you don't have the money to retry these cases, because that's part of their excuse, that we don't have the money. It's just thousands of cases. But they know that this law was racist back then as of December 2018, and we're saying that it's racist now as of January 2019, and that these people deserve a chance, an opportunity to get
get a fair trial or else let go free. And so what they're saying is, no, we're going to kick them under the bus. We don't care about the fact that they was convicted up under this racist law. We're just going to start fresh. And we're saying, no, you're going to go back and you're going to make it right for those people that you know for a fact that was railroaded and lynched in the courtroom under this unconstitutional law.
That was Belinda Parker Brown of Louisiana United International speaking from New Orleans.
Anti-war activists from across the country are getting ready to converge on Washington, D.C. for a week of protests against U.S. wars. Actions will begin on March 30th and continue to April 4th. That's the anniversary of the 1968 assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. But instead, official Washington is throwing a big party to celebrate the formation of NATO, the U.S. military alliance with Europe. Netfer Freeman is with the Black Alliance for Peace.
We're part of the No Foreign Bases Coalition and a whole host of organizations that are mobilizing on March 30th to oppose NATO. The United States government and the Western allies have chosen this time to commemorate the anniversary of the 70th anniversary of NATO, which is actually on April 4th. And so people are mobilizing to stand against this or make an expression against war and imperialism and the increasing militarization, U.S. militarization of the world. And also on April 4th, which is the actual anniversary of NATO, it's also the memorial for the 50th memorial of Dr. King's assassination. And so this is, we are seeing this as a grotesque desecration of the legacy of Dr. King, of someone who stood as opposed to war and militarism and capitalism and imperialism and those things. And so we are also, on that date is the celebration of NATO that will take place at the State Department. And we're mobilizing to have an action during the day to demonstrate, protest this celebration. And then in the evening, we're having a forum at Plymouth Congregational Church in Washington, D.C., which we are actually honored that you'll be a guest keynote speaker and a number of other speakers during that event in the evening from 7 to 9 p.m. We're going to have the event No Compromise, No Retreat in the Fight to End Militarism and War. It will be emceed by Jeriba Hill of the Mississippi Workers Center for Human Rights. And we'll also have speaking Margaret Kimberly of Black Agenda Report, Vanessa Beck, who's on the Coordinating Committee of Black Alliance for Peace, then G-Way McHarris from Movement for Black Lives, Dr. Rose Brewer from Black Alliance for Peace, and who's also a scholar activist out of Minnesota, and Gina Betts, who's the mother of India Kager, whose daughter, India Kager, was murdered by police. So, and then myself will be on the panel. This is when we're going to also launch the domestic side of the Black Alliances for Peace campaign. So we had first the Shutdown AFRICOM, U.S. out of Africa, but also we know that the U.S. militarization is extending into our communities inside the United States with the militarization of the police, and also just a war against African people that's more than just the police, that goes into the mass incarceration, the persecution and continued persecution of our political prisoners, and even the collaboration with Israel in repressing our communities right here. The police actually train together and figure out ways to continue the occupations in the respective countries.
In addition to protesting the NATO celebration held on the assassination date of Dr. Martin Luther King, you're also demanding that the Congressional Black Caucus and the Progressive Caucus oppose Donald Trump's economic sanctions against Venezuela and his threats of military intervention.
Yeah, because obviously, so one, people are really need to understand that the nature of imperialism right now is in a stage where they're really trying to increase the domination of the world with a shrinking economy and them also losing their place as a world power. And Donald Trump's administration seems to be shifting its focus to this hemisphere, stepping up an enforcement of the Monroe Doctrine and that legacy. And so we know that any military actions and also the sanctions against Venezuela or any place disproportionately affect our people. And just the fact that they're inhumane anyway, no matter who they affect, we should be opposed to those things. And so Afro-Venezuelans have made a pronouncement that says they don't want war, but they're preparing for it. They're ready for it. They want to prepare for it. And they're asking us. And it's not just because they're asking us, because this is our principal position, is to stand against the sanctions and against any threat or military intervention in that country or any place in the world anyway. And so we've called for that, and the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, we're working along with them, who've put out a petition that's calling for the Congressional Black Caucus and the Congressional Progressive Caucus to support the bill H.R. 1004, which prohibits the unauthorized military action in Venezuela and also an end to the sanctions. So we're working with the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, who have put out a petition, and we're working to get signatures and distribute this petition that calls on the Congressional Black Caucus and the Congressional Progressive Caucus to support the end of the sanctions and the H.R. 1004 bill that not only calls for the end of sanctions, but also prohibits the unauthorized military action being proposed against Venezuela. And so we've also, along with them and groups around the country, have been mobilizing and demonstrating that this is not in line with the popular will of the people of the United States. So these representatives that are lining up to do this are in violation of their oath to represent the constituency, because this is not anything that's popular. And so we know that this capitalist dictatorship, you know, has a tendency not to honor the wishes of the constituencies and the electorate, but we know that we have to organize and by any means necessary and on all fronts to resist their plans and their agenda.
There are almost 50 black members of the U.S. House of Representatives, but only 7 have signed on to Khanna's bill to end U.S. sanctions and threats of military intervention against Venezuela. So obviously the Congressional Black Caucus has no position against war and sanctions.
And that shouldn't surprise us. I mean, it's been a long time since we can even say that the Congressional Black Caucus, or the majority of Congressional Black Caucus representatives, have supported or been in line with their constituency and not been beholden to corporate interests and even that of war. And so, yeah, it's not surprising. And I think they're more silent right now when it comes to that, because they know that there's a groundswell on the groundswell that's opposing this. And so we'll have to see in the end how everyone votes, and we hope that they'll do the right thing. But at the same time, we really have to look at getting them to have an unequivocal position on so many things related to militarism. AFRICOM, for example, I mean, they all seem to have to accept, and I guess if they're concerned about their careers and how they're seen in the corporate media, they all seem to have to parrot some narrative that's really out of sync with what the world and the reality when it comes to countries. They have to parrot narrative that maligns the leadership and the self-determination of peoples around the world, that makes it seem like there's some American exceptionalism or that the United States is in a position of moral authority to police the world. And so if they talk like Sister Cynthia McKinney used to do, then it costs them their careers. We see now with some of the newer members of the Congress, like Sister Ilhan Omar, who are being more outspoken about these kind of things and pushing the envelope. And we've also seen many of these people, and this was in relationship to Palestine, but also I remember her making a statement also denouncing the military or the aggressive actions against Venezuela. And then in response to that, we're seeing a new generation of people who are supporting her and rallying around her. But we also need to increase our general understanding, our political education around issues of internationalism. People have to understand what real socialism is, where the masses are determining policy on a state level. Of course, it's a little bit more than just projects of cooperatives and things like that and social safety nets, but it's actually where we can actually determine policy. And the policymakers are beholden to our interests and not those of capitalists. That's what socialism is. And then also what participatory democracy is. I mean, these are countries, the countries that are maligned as being dictatorships do a much better job of including and being able to facilitate the will of the people when it comes to their policies. And so I think on some level, a lot of people are against it because they just think it's wrong for the United States to go in and no matter what. But I don't know if they've reached the point of understanding that these are not dictatorships, that the propaganda offensive against them, which is goes hand in hand with the aggression, the military and physical aggression against them, is false. And that there's a lot we can learn from countries like Venezuela and Cuba. And so we just have to do a kind of match our will of anti-intervention with also what we need to push forward in this country.
That was Nepha Freeman of the Black Alliance for Peace.
The arrival of two Muslim women in the U.S. Congress has focused unprecedented attention on Israel's policies towards Palestinians. A recent congressional resolution claimed to denounce all forms of religious and racial bias, but it was widely seen as being directed against Muslim Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. Suwad Abdul Kabir is an anthropologist, artist, and activist who teaches at the University of Michigan. She teamed up with other Muslim and Jewish women to write an article titled "How Targeting Ilhan Omar Instead of White Supremacy Furthered Both Anti-Semitism and Islamophobia."
When the resolution came out and it identified anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and white supremacy. And this is their way of being inclusive and sort of, we're no longer targeting Representative Omar. But I think that framing actually was a problem. And one of the things we argue is that it's not that anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, anti-Muslim racism, and white supremacy are three different things that are attacking three different distinct populations, but rather that white supremacy is the issue. And from that come that anti-Semitism, comes racism and violence against Black people, comes genocide against Indigenous people. Like, these things come from white supremacy, right? Because white supremacy is a system. It's a historic system of exploitation and power. So I think a lot of times what happens in our conversations, and this is also, I think, part of the logic of white supremacy, is that we think of marginalized groups, groups who are victimized, as these sort of distinct, discrete groups. So this happens to Jews, this happens to Black people, this happens to Muslims, this happens to Indigenous people, and they're very, but it's really important to recognize and understand how the ways in which people are targeted for violence, for discrimination, both by everyday folks as well as by government institutions, are interconnected, and they're not sort of these kind of siloed forms of discrimination. And so that ultimately, if we want to end one of them, and all of them, we really have to get at white supremacy, and we really have to sort of undo the way it is institutionalized and systemic, both in the United States, but also globally.
Yes, the Democratic leadership behaved as if Representative Omar was the problem, just like white folks used to speak of the Negro problem.
Yes, indeed, indeed, yeah. I think, and that was one of the things we also kind of talked about a little bit in the piece too, thinking about, you know, W.E. Du Bois and this question of being a problem, and she becomes a problem. And I think one of the things we tried to point out in the article is the ways in which her racial, gender, religious, and even like her citizenship sort of status identity, being a refugee and becoming a citizen, how those things kind of made her a problem on multiple levels. And in all these ways, she's an embodiment of people who don't belong or shouldn't be in power or shouldn't have power or shouldn't be questioning in these kinds of ways. Like, how did you get here? You know? And so I think for those reasons, she became really a convenient political target, because from a lot of different vantage points, people are concerned or worried about what she represents. And we saw that too in the aftermath of the resolution. Then there was that Fox News person who was sort of questioning Representative Omar in terms of, because she wears a scarf, and then all these kind of fears about Sharia law and what does that mean? You know, these ghosts or myths around Muslims are, who Black folks are, what they're really doing, what they should or not be able to do, kind of also reared their head even after ostensibly the issue was quote unquote closed because they did a new resolution, right? But she continues to be, I think, targeted.
You also point out that AIPAC does not represent all Jews. And that's important because although AIPAC feels it's its duty to defend Israel's political behavior no matter what, that does not mean that all Jews defend that behavior or that criticism of AIPAC is criticism of Jews.
No, definitely. And that was one of the points, too. And this is why it was really important, I think, too, for this piece to come out with a collective voice from Black Muslim and Black Jewish women, because I think there is this way in which people sort of suture support for Israel to Jewish identity. And those are not the same thing. And AIPAC itself, they don't call themselves a Jewish organization, but they say they support a Jewish state. And while one of the things that we mentioned in the article is that their core membership is Jewish, but they don't speak for all Jews, and that really AIPAC is a part of an pro-Israel lobby, but that pro-Israel lobby data shows is not really driven by American Jews, but by evangelical Christians. And so there's this significant population of evangelical Christians who have a particular end of times sort of belief system, and that Israel has a role to play in that. And so for that reason, they support Israel, and they part of the support Israel lobby. And I think that was one of the points that I know one of our authors really wanted us to make sure we made that point. Because again, if we're going to try to undo this conflation of support for Israel with Jewish identity, we have to recognize not only that AIPAC doesn't represent all Jews, but that even the pro-Israel lobby doesn't represent all Jews. And there are non-Jews, particularly evangelical Christians, who are very much in support of Israel, but not because they're driven to protect Jewish life, but that's not what that's about, but because of what they believe about what Israel will do for their own belief system.
Representative Omar, after all of this discourse about what she did or did not do, said, but still, where is the attention to what is happening in Palestine? And most Americans still don't know that the Israelis on the Gaza border shot 6,000 Palestinians unarmed and killed almost 200 of them.
No, and I think that And this is really, I think, part of what we were trying to do and part of what we need to do with this conversation is really bring it to the substantive issue. And this is these kind of human rights abuses by the Israeli government in occupied Palestine, but also in Israel, too. And like you mentioned, there was a great March of Return protest in Gaza, and the UN, when they sort of evaluate what happened, you know, these 6,000 Palestinians that were shot were unarmed. They were kids, journalists, doctors who were killed. And this was a war crime. And then, of course, the blockade of Gaza, because all movement of people and goods into Gaza is controlled by Israel. So then Gaza is understood as the world's largest open prison because people are living without proper food and electricity. All the things you need to live your life, people are not able to do that, as well as the Israeli government continuing to support settlements in the West Bank. And then, and this is also, I think, particularly important to us as Black people, is the ways in which anti-Blackness also converges with human rights abuses in Israel. So the ways in which Ethiopian Jews face discrimination and police brutality, these efforts to push out non-Jewish African asylum seekers, sort of killing of unarmed protesters, denial of rights, denying asylum seekers. These are really important and significant things. And we really need to sort of be talking about that. As U.S. citizens, our job then is to sort of really push and pressure our elected officials to change our stance as a country towards that. Rather than supporting or aiding and abetting it, we really need to push the Israeli government to change its ways.
Suad Abdul Kabir. One of Kabir's co-writers was Asha Noor, a racial justice and human rights activist of Somali descent. Noor emphasizes that white supremacy is the grandfather of all the other religious and racial evils.
At the core, we should be resisting against white supremacy, which these isms are rooted in, and not the other way around. Like, we shouldn't be defaming or attacking a Black Muslim woman for calling out how white supremacy functions. And by design, her silencing and her backlash is anti-Black and rooted also in white supremacy.
Yes, and by silencing people like Representative Omar and creating a taboo against criticism of Israel, all of these isms are allowed in Israel and globally and in the United States to operate.
Absolutely. The fact that Israel has this high level of protection in terms of not being able to critique it or talk about it really makes it difficult for advocates, activists, thinkers, just anyone who's concerned about the human rights violations to come forward and to speak about it. And we see that with Representative Omar, because she has been vocal about AIPAC and Israel, and instead of giving her or allowing for her to use her constitutional rights to free speech, there's a chilling effect, and she's being silenced by both people on the left and on the right, because as we know, Israel and AIPAC are untouchable in America's political landscape.
Now, the Democrats claim to be the party of diversity, and they like to take pictures with people like Representative Omar in them, but they don't seem to like it when Omar and others open their mouths.
Yes, and this point just goes to show that diversity oftentimes is something that is just for public consumption, something that you can look at, something that seems nice in a very tokenized way, rather than a meaningful way of actually having differing views and approaches to some of the issues that we have in this country. So that diversity, again, is meant to be seen but not heard.
People in the United States are shocked having heard what happened in Christchurch, New Zealand. But most folks in this country aren't even aware that attacks against Muslims here are at an all-time high.
Absolutely. When folks were watching the stories come out of New Zealand, a lot of Americans were horrified and appalled, rightfully so, because it, you know, was a great tragedy. At the same time, though, hate crimes against Muslims are at the highest that they have been since 9/11. So a lot of Americans don't know that. They don't know that there are vandalisms of mosques all around the country, and there are hate crimes in every part of this country targeting Muslims. So it's kind of like something that we're all too familiar with, this sort of ethnocentric approach to life. Like everywhere else is dealing with these issues, and we're significantly better or not as worse.
Clearly, the resolution directed against Representative Omar was a blunt instrument to silence criticism of Israel. But those instruments now take the form of law to silence folks who advocate for the BDS movement.
Yes, BDS, this whole conversation, you know, has been going on for quite some time. You know, we've seen in the history of this country, the large portions of Americans supporting other boycotts and other means of divesting from apartheid states. However, when it comes to Israel, it's as if you just can't even boycott or divest. Although we know, those who work on a lot of these issues and progressive issues know, that there are clear human rights violations happening, and a divestment or boycotting is well within Americans' rights to do so. But we see legislation propping up all around the country to push back against BDS and to criminalize it.
Have you yourself felt the temperatures of anti-Muslim feelings rise in this country over time?
Absolutely. I work in this field. I work on, you know, combating Islamophobia and racism and things of that nature, really. And so for me, I'm constantly getting intakes, complaints, so on and so forth, of anti-Muslim racism in my line of work, but also on a personal level. You know, I see friends and family going through these issues on a daily. I myself have experienced anti-Muslim racism or bigotry. And we see it on the rise now. Individuals who were operating from a place of hate and ignorance and violence are emboldened to carry those acts out now. And so that's sort of what we're seeing. But that doesn't mean this sentiment is new. It just means that there are more people willing to act on it in a violent way.
Meanwhile, the Trump administration is carrying on an ongoing campaign against those UN bodies that have criticized Israel.
Yes, I mean, this is the one, as I mentioned earlier, issue area that is untouchable. It really riles people up on the left and right because it's an issue like our relationship to Israel is so intertwined, it's so entrenched that any sort of question from the left or the right, or even from, you know, the United Nations or other bodies that are responsible for overseeing human rights violations, their say and their criticism will not be accepted by the United States government. And it doesn't matter if you're a left-leaning president or right-leaning president. You know, we had President Obama, and the general American who was a Democrat viewed him as some sort of messiah who came to save us all. But those of us who have been doing this work understand that some of the most brutal policies against people of color came out under his administration. And there was still that unequivocal support of Israel, just as there is now under Trump. So it's not really a partisan issue.
You are of Somali extraction, as is Representative Omar. The United States has been waging a military campaign at various levels in Somalia since at least 2006, and yet there is almost no coverage of it, as if that campaign is not inflicting harm on real people.
Yeah, this is, again, another lesser known point, is that there have been drone strikes and targeted campaigns in Somalia for many years, especially under President Obama, where these strikes increased. I believe that Obama was in 7 Muslim countries during the tenure of his presidency and using targeted drone strikes. This is not a secret. However, it's not something that Americans really want to think about or see as a legitimate issue. Like, you know, when we saw the victims of the New Zealand mosque attack, it was completely horrifying. And, you know, every single life that was lost was valued and valuable. However, when we look at it from a nation state perspective, we don't want to look at the fact that the United States is responsible for thousands of Muslim deaths in recent years because of these drone strikes and because of, you know, U.S. intervention and because of U.S. aggression and U.S. wars. So there's this level of dissonance, like, okay, you know, wow, this is such a horrific thing that happened to these people, and we stand with our Muslim brothers and sisters in humanity. But then we're not going to look at the war on terror policies, which has wiped out thousands of Muslims globally and incarcerated, criminalized, and investigated countless Muslims in the United States as well. Built an entire prison in a foreign country, Guantanamo, to criminalize without any sort of oversight more Muslims.
Yes, virtually all of the countries targeted by the United States drone wars are Muslim countries. One could draw the conclusion that U.S. administrations have implicit permission from the American public to bomb Muslims.
Yeah, and I think it's because in large part, the American public isn't really seeking out this information. And the media is not also aiding in, you know, exposing these truths. So unless you happen to be interested in this area or interested in international relations or just are a critical thinker, you may not come across this information. And so that's kind of what we're seeing. It's sort of like dissonance of when a life matters. When you're a victim of the war on terror from the United States and you're Muslim, whether you're incarcerated, droned, just a number of horrific measures against you, it's not seen as legitimate versus something like the massacre that happened in New Zealand. That's seen as more of a, like, those lives seem like they are the type of Muslim lives that you can mourn versus these invisible lives that are just being droned in the middle of the night.
That was racial justice and human rights activist Asha Noor.
The nation's best known political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, has some thoughts on the massacre of Muslims at prayer in New Zealand.
Live stream. A young Aussie killer invades a set of Muslim mosques and commits a massacre of men, women, and even children. The young man publishes a maniacal manuscript decrying Muslim invaders of Europe while slaughtering Muslims at prayer and in meditation. Online, millions view this carnage live as it happened in Christchurch, a city in New Zealand. The author of this horror was reportedly a white nationalist who expressed opposition to Muslim immigrants. New Zealand, a nation mostly composed of two islands in the Southeast Pacific Ocean, is mostly white people from Britain who number in the millions. The Maori, indigenous people who are of Polynesian ancestry, have lived there for at least 500 years before European arrival, with the 18th century exploitations of British Captain James Cook. As a result of European Maori warfare, Maori were reduced to less than 100,000 people. Today, 200,000 Maori survive. So who are the invaders? New Zealand now has a population of about 4.5 million, 71% of which are of European ancestry. Kind of makes you wonder, again, who invaded whom? At last count, some 50 Muslims were slain. And an Australian man in his 20s is charged in connection with what we call the Christchurch Massacre. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Six inmates from the federal prison at Segoville, Texas, were discovered to have done work at a church attended by the regional director of prisons, who oversees about 30,000 inmates in six southern states. The Texas prisoners were paid just 49 cents an hour. Lauren Gill reported on the incident for The Appeal, a publication that focuses on the U.S. criminal justice system.
The employees that I spoke to about this, what they told me is this just seemed like a very clear-cut case of prison labor exploitation. And then even, you know, I asked the federal prison media office, you know, what are your rules on this? And they said that prison's employees are not allowed to use inmates on projects for personal gain. And if you think about it, certainly having your church landscaped for free seems like personal gain.
And you talked to the preacher of the church about the use of inmate labor, and he seemed to think that they got off easy because his volunteers at the church worked for free.
Right, yeah. He thought, you know, he was offering these incarcerated people an opportunity to get out and do work. You know, he was telling me, I'm so proud of them. They did a great job. They had a really good attitude. And I asked him, you know, do you know what they were paid? And he said, no, I don't know that. And I told him, and yeah, he basically said what you just said, that they're getting paid a lot more than the volunteers who worked on 2 days and they did the work for free.
Now, this prison official, John Carraway, he's in charge of about 30,000 inmates in a number of states in that region.
Right, yeah, 5 states. So that's quite a wide reach. And, you know, I talked to the employees, and the employee said, well, you know, if he's doing this over in Segalville, you know, you have to wonder what's going on in the other states as well.
Now, all of this use of prison labor came just before a strike in 2018 by inmates who were protesting, among other things, the use of them as a kind of slave labor.
Right, yeah. The 2018 national prison strike, I mean, that was a huge deal. And one of the demands was that people are paid fair wages for their work and the prevailing wage in their state. So under that, the people who did this church work should have been paid around $7.25 an hour instead of $3.92 a day.
Now, this high-ranking prison official, as we said, he's in charge of 30,000 inmates. Is he still in charge?
Well, according to the people I spoke to, he's put in his papers, and that was, I guess, maybe February when I heard that. And he's set to retire in a few months.
With a full pension, despite having broken all the rules.
As far as I've heard, that's the case. So one of the things that I think is important from this story is that, you know, if you look at the statistics, 97% of federal prisoners are going to be released one day. And what I heard was over at Segalville, these inmates are getting about 3 opportunities each year, and maybe that's, you know, a few prisoners who are chosen to go out into the community and do work. And in the other case, they go to the regional office and they do sort of like maintenance work. But I think it's really important to take into account that, you know, there's a real need for more job training and more rehabilitative programs. In this case, the prisoners are very vulnerable to exploitation because they don't really get a chance to go out into the community and do things that will, you know, help their skill set and set them up for success, you know, once they get out one day. But I think it's important for federal prisons, you know, the First Step Act, they have $250 million allocated for job training over the next 5 years. So I think it's important to see, you know, how this job training is used in a fair way that'll also provide inmates with the skill set that they want and that they need.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.